time of 8 a.m. having arrived, I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order. Welcome, members. We do have some minutes. Representative Les Lagarde moves approval of the February 27th, 2020 minutes. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, I'm going to call for the vote on those minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The February 27th, 2020 minutes, 2020 minutes are approved. Very good. First bill on the agenda is House File 2601, and I'll wait for Representative Schultz to get to the table, and then... Representative, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move my bill, House File 2601, please.
All right, House File 2601, move for possible inclusion into the House Omnibus bill, and there is a DE1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
I would like to move the DE1 amendment as well.
Representative Schultz moves the DE1 amendment. Representative Fabian?
So, Mr. Chair, there's a lot of other components in this bill, and you're moving it for possible inclusion. Shouldn't this go to the Housing Committee first?
Representative Schultz. I think,
yes, thank you, Chair Markwart. So this was heard in Housing last year, and under House File 884, Representative Fabian, you're the second author on the bill, and it got redrafted because this House File 884 is in Ways and Means. So this bill was submitted and was referred directly to the Tax Committee.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the bill has changed. I mean, it's been redrafted, but there are changes to it, correct?
Representative Schultz.
There are changes to the dates, the effective dates. And I don't see 884 here, but I think loans were the loans change was in House File 884. That was heard in Housing last year.
Representative Fabian.
Okay, so was that accounted for in a fiscal note then? You know, the extra work, there's going to be more work over there for the agency to do. More FTEs or something.
Right. Representative Schultz.
Chair Markwart, the fiscal note is in your packet, I believe, and it is reflective of the DE1.
The revenue, there's a revenue estimate revenue here. I don't know if there's a fiscal.
Right.
I don't know, Ms. Templin, Ms. Schill, is there a fiscal note here? Or? Okay. We will check on that. As far as the fiscal note, but for the 884, not for this one, right?
Yeah.
So
Sorry. Yeah, there's a revenue note. Sorry for the DE1 in your packet. Right. I'm not sure if there was a fiscal note generated for 884.
Okay. Yeah, sure. We've got a revenue note, but we're checking to see if there's a fiscal note on this. But otherwise, Representative Schultz, say what are the differences from the bill that was heard in Housing last year?
So the differences are the effective date of July 1st, 2020, line 3.3 was modified. And let me call a friend.
I believe it's the addition of...
And would you state your name, please?
I'm Jeff Corey, Executive Director at One Roof Community Housing.
Okay, and what other changes?
I believe the main change was that loans were included in addition to grants.
Yeah, I think Ms. Hagler, would you want to chime in here?
Yes, Mr. Chair and representatives, the DE1 amendment is a DE solely because this section of statute 462A.38 was amended in 2019. If you look on line 1.9, and 1.8 where it says two cities and then tribal governments, that was a 2019 change, which was also in the 884 bill. So that part of the bill was enacted in the Housing omnibus bill last year. However, all of the references to loans And all of the effective dates are what is updated for this version.
Any Representative Fabian?
Well, just to be clear, Mr. Chair, I've done a lot of work with housing and so forth, and I just want to make sure that this is going through the correct process. And it just, it's obvious to me that it should be in housing. But.
Yeah, it did. I mean, basically, what, 97% of this bill, I think, was heard in housing. So, the effective date is being changed, and the loan part was added, and I think that's primarily it, I think.
Representative Schultz? I'm being told that the loan piece was in the original House Bill 884. So that piece was heard in housing.
Okay.
And only pieces, like you said, 90% or more was the same from the housing. We just updated the effective dates.
Yeah. So, we can always look at this too, but I think this is the proper place for it at this point. If it hadn't been heard in housing, then yes, I would agree, but it's been through housing already. But Representative
Thank
Fabian.
You, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for dragging this out, but just to be clear, has the DE as it's written been heard in housing?
See, if the language is different. Yeah.
I would say no. I don't think the DE-1 has been heard in housing, but so we've got a motion on the DE-1. Any further discussion on the DE-1 amendment? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor of the DE-1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
No. The motion does prevail. The DE-1 amendment is adopted. Representative Schultz, to your bill as amended.
Okay. In 2016, legislative session, the Workforce and Affordable Homeownership Development Program was established, I believe, with Representative Fabian's support. The purpose of the program was to award homeownership grants to nonprofit organizations, certain cooperatives, and certain community land trusts in order to develop workforce and affordable homeownership projects. The goal was to increase the supply of workforce and affordable owner-occupied housing in Minnesota. And funds awarded under this program were used for development costs, rehabilitation, land development, and residential housing. This bill expands the program to include loans in addition to grants. It also establishes a workforce and affordable home ownership development account in the Housing Development Fund. One of the major changes from 2016 was to allow loans in addition to grants. And this is designed to keep the funds in affordable housing. So when a grant is given out, for instance, that money is spent on affordable housing development just once. The idea behind adding loans is to make that allocated tax revenue go much further. So I have two testifiers with me today, Chair Marquardt.
Very good.
And the first is Jeff Corey.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Again, I'm Jeff Corey. I'm the Executive Director at One Roof Community Housing. Our organization serves the community of Duluth, Cloquet, Two Harbors, Hermantown, Proctor, Grand Marais, and some areas in between in northeastern Minnesota. Our organization has four prime lines of business. We do home buyer education and counseling and tenant landlord education, counseling, and mediation. We do lending for home improvement loans. We do multifamily housing development, and we do single-family housing development. Our flagship program, arguably, is our community land trust work, where we have a little over 300 houses in portfolio and have managed nearly 180 resales of community land trust homes. I want to thank Representative Schultz for her leadership on this bill and for Representative Fabian for his initial leadership in helping us craft this. Heard earlier the bill would allow for capturing of the annual growth in the mortgage registry and deed tax. The annual growth would go toward affordable homeownership development. The idea is to create a dedicated source of revenue that would ensure that funding for homeownership development and creating new affordable homes would be effectively doubled in normal years. The reason that my colleagues around the state and I are active on trying to push for more resources for affordable home ownership is that there are 27,000 renters right now in the state that could move to affordable home ownership if there were units available. So it's really about helping folks move along the continuum of housing and move into homeownership. At this time, about 4%, we reckon 4% of Minnesota Housing Finance Agency resources are geared toward homeownership production in terms of lowering the cost and creating new units of housing. We think it's a smart investment. It's the case that, you know, the typical investment in an affordable home is about a quarter of what it is in an affordable rental situation. So we would really like to see an increase in funding for homeownership to be able to bring it a little bit closer to on par with the creation of affordable rental housing. One of the big reasons we're asking for this support is that there's a very broad homeownership gap disparity in households of color in our state. We have a quite high homeownership ratio for white households, 76% actually, but only 24% of African American families are homeowners. My colleagues and I that are organizing around this particular bill are quite adept at helping households of color. We serve 7 times the rate of households of color to help purchase homes as the market does. So we think we know how to do this well, and if we had more resources, we could really help close that gap. You know, I think one of the things to think about with regard to why pushing forward with more resources for homeownership are just what does homeownership do for a family? You know, I would ask you to consider, you know, how many of you own your own homes? How many of you grew up in homes that were owned by your families? And what did that mean for you? What kind of stability does that bring for your children, your grandchildren? What kind of a platform does that give a family to be able to be as self-actualized as they can be as they walk through the world, and to do the things that contribute to, you know, a healthy community, whether that's volunteering at your church, in your schools, performing well in your job, whatever the case may be. Stable housing is a really important baseline and platform for people from which to grow and do all that they can do. The pilot program a few years ago for allocated $750,000. It was wildly oversubscribed with applications. I can't remember how many, but it was several million dollars of applications came forward for just that amount of money. Last year's bill allocated, I think, $250,000 per year, and you know we could do, you know, 10 times that amount if we had the opportunity, 20 times that amount if we had the opportunity. So I would like to introduce Portia Jackson now. Portia's the Homeownership Services Program Manager for Putterhorn Residence Group, PRG in Minneapolis, and she works with a lot of clients that could benefit from increased homeownership production in our state, and I think she has a pretty interesting story to tell you as well.
Thank you. Ms. Jackson, welcome. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. My name is Portia Jackson, and I am the Homeownership Advising Services Program Manager for PRG. We are the largest, or the organization that educates the most people in person for pre-purchase education. We also provide one-on-one pre-purchase advising, foreclosure prevention, and refinance counseling as well. The first thing I want to say is that, you know, I'm a first generation home buyer, and without these opportunities and without these different organizations and the loans and the affordable housing, I wouldn't be able to own a home. My experience is that I have actually gone through the entire housing continuum. I'm originally from Gary, Indiana. I moved here in about 1992. We did move into a rental and then became upon hard times and ended up having to go to a homeless shelter. So I've lived in homeless shelters, I've lived in transitional housing, I've lived with Section 8 housing, and I actually was on Section 8 before I bought my house I was renting and I bought my house about 5 years ago. Moving along that continuum is something that I help people do every day. because people do want to have the pride of the American dream, which is homeownership. And so that's kind of why I do the work I do. I actually start off as working in social work. So I've worked in, you know, different counties in the welfare department, child protection, things like that. So I've always wanted to work helping people. But I did notice when I was going on my journey to home ownership that, you know, there were organizations that I had never even heard of that were doing this work. Of course, we've heard of, you know, the different shelters and, you know, Section 8 program, but we don't always think about home ownership as an affordable, viable way to live, basically. My parents didn't own a home. I had, you know, no frame of reference for that, so I had to seek out different organizations. And actually, PRG, the organization that I run the program for now, is one of the organizations that I went to find, you know, how I could be successful in home ownership. So that's, like I said, that's what I do every day, is try to get people. The first thing is to even get people to buy the idea that they can do this, because we have, as especially African-American people, have been, you know, pushed down so far so long that that's just something that we don't even think about. If we have a Section 8 voucher, then, you know, we made it. That's it. Like, that's great. But then you also have to think about the fact that children age up, which means that if you have a three-bedroom now when your kids are little, when they get older, you might have to go down to a one-bedroom Section 8 voucher or something like that, and you may not be able to move and do what you want to do. You can't really stay stable. You can't really have a foundation if you're always mobile every few years. So, and that's the reason why I do this work. Like I said, PRG, we provide the most pre-purchase home buyer education, but we also get a lot of people of color into home ownership. We did conduct a survey, and we do that every 3 years. The good news is that PRG continues to play a critical role in narrowing the racial homeownership gap. Our survey, that survey 2016 to 2019, showed that we had a narrowing gap. So in 2013 to 16, we had a 30%. And then in 2019, we found that it was only 21% between the houses of color that we serve and white households. The bad news is that the overall rate of purchase decreased from 70% in the period of 2014 to 16 to 54% in 2017 to 2019. And that's directly attributable to the historic low inventory levels. So basically, we're getting people ready, but we don't have anything for them to buy. And this is particularly on homes for sale that are less than $250,000. Most people start off in homes around that area, maybe lower, and there just isn't the inventory available for them to get into. So like I said, I get people ready, and my whole stitch is, you know, get ready, be ready, but I really want people to actually have something to get ready to buy once they're ready to, because we have plenty of people that are sitting on our rolls right now that are looking diligently, have been looking for over a year, and haven't been able to find something affordable for their family in the neighborhoods that they want to live in. So basically, addressing this inventory problem is the only way that we're going to address the fact that we're the second worst in the nation when it comes to the home ownership gap. And it has the added benefit of freeing up rental units. Like I said, there's a continuum. So if you have somebody that's in a rental unit that could own a home, then guess what? That rental unit frees up for another family that may need it. So yeah, we definitely want to have that happen and hope that you all can support that.
Thank you very much. Representative Schultz, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, but I just went through House File 884, and I just want to clarify one last time what the difference. The difference is just the dates. So the loans, that language was in House File 884 that was heard in housing. So the only change is line 2.13, will update the date. Lines 2.24, the dates fiscal years 2021 to 2031 instead of 20 to 30. Lines 2.28, those dates, and line 3.3. So all the other language is exactly identical to House File 884.
Okay. Representative Schultz, thank you very much. Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't so much a question for the testifier as it is about the revenue note. So I don't know if the author or somebody from revenue would.
Ms. Schill, would you care to address that?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome.
Kathy Schill, House Fiscal. Representative Lean, you had a question on the revenue estimate.
I do. Thank you, Ms. Schill. I am wondering what is causing the precipitous drop in revenue available for this program between fiscal year 21 and 23.
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lean, I provided the committee with a table that looks like this, and I'm assuming that you are looking at the table. The revenue estimate gives the totals, but the table provides some additional information. What's going on is that the formula used for determining how much money would be diverted from the mortgage registry and deed transfer taxes into the proposed affordable workforce housing program. It's all dependent on how much revenue comes in the preceding year, and what happens with the recent February 2020 forecast is that revenues projected for fiscal 19 compared to fiscal 18 are lower than expected.
Went upstairs and got your table.
Excuse me. According to this table, if you look at the mortgage, current law, mortgage and deed, what I've done is I've got different columns that add together revenues from mortgage registry tax, deed transfer tax, and then you have the sum of those called current law, mortgage and deed. If you look at the four lines at the bottom of the table, February 2020 forecast, you'll see that revenues projected for fiscal 20 total $291 million. And then for fiscal 2021, revenues projected are $281 million and change. And so when revenues are lower than what the preceding year revenues are, the calculation will not put money into the workforce housing program. So you have to have net revenues exceeding the preceding year for any money to be diverted from the mortgage registry and deed transfer tax to go into the fund. And so the first year of the calculation, yes, that compares fiscal 19 to fiscal 20, and that's where you have the increment at 42.7 million in growth, and that amount would be going into the workforce housing fund, but the following year the revenues would be lower and therefore there would be none. And then the following year there is a small increment projected at 2.4 million. So whenever the growth exceeds the previous year, then money would be diverted. When it does not, there would be nothing.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schill, so basically it's based on the housing market.
Yep. Correct.
The health of the housing.
Yes, market. Mr. Okay. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Ms. Schill? All right. Thank you. Michelle.
Mr. Chair and members, if I could, I did find a revenue estimate a fiscal note anticipating cost to the general fund. I did not find it for House File 884, but I did find it for the previous year's bill, which is actually Representative Fabian's bill. That's House File 3377. And the fiscal note came back as zero, because the department uses non-general funds to administer the current grant program, and so they anticipated on absorbing those costs and using non-general fund money.
Thank you. Any other testifiers that would like to testify on House File 2601 as amended? Seeing none, I do want to thank Mr. Corey and Ms. Jackson for your testimony, and Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, thanks for your work on this. Just a couple of things, and this is kind of an editorial. I've talked to the housing folks many times, and I appreciate on page 2 that this is a statewide program, and we want to try to get it out to all corners of the state, evenly divided between the metro area and outstate, greater Minnesota. But what continues to be a problem for many of us, where we do have real, we have a lot of job opportunities, a lot of openings. When we go down to the bottom of this page, on the first page, 1.20 down through 1.22, these grants are made available to people who meet the income limits. And in my part of the state, well, in my hometown, just 2 blocks from my house, we have a new apartment building that was built, and we have 12 or 14 units sitting empty because we don't have the demand for the income limits. You know, we've talked a lot about market rate workforce housing. So if Mr. Corey could help me understand how this bill may or may not help serve that niche, that market that's missing in my part of the state. And we have nothing against income-based housing, but we just have an oversupply of that, and so now those units sit empty.
Sure. Mr. Corey.
Thank you. I do think that that this particular way of doing affordable housing will work better in rural Minnesota, where the dynamic you just explained exists, Representative Fabian. In particular, you know, there is an income limit on this resource, but it's at 115% of area median income, whereas the income limit that is attributable to most of the rental housing that's created is 60% of area median income at the highest and often lower than that. So this would make a demonstrable difference in terms of the number of folks that would qualify for it. One other quick thing I meant to mention earlier is that we get about 200 applications a year for folks that want to buy a house. We only are able to serve 25 to 30 based on normal allocation of resources in Duluth and surrounding communities. So there's far more need than there are resources to meet that need.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of get that on the record so that it's there.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, Mr. Corey could answer this. Do more of the, of course, we're moving it to loans, I think, for the first time, but did more of the grants, Mr. Corey, go to nonprofits than to cities in the past when we created this program?
Mr. Corey.
I believe in the first round of funding that was allocated, it all went to nonprofits.
And
Representative
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Corey, do we know whether or not with that money going to nonprofits or to whomever, does that drive up the cost of construction because now there's government money flowing in?
Mr. Corey.
I don't know that I can speak for the entirety of the state with regard to that dynamic, but I don't believe in my community that the government resources drive up the cost of construction. There are some regulatory changes that could be made to lower a few things associated with it, but I would say generally the bid is the bid. There are some regulatory changes that could be made, but I don't think just because it's government money it drives it up wildly.
Thank you, Mr. Corey, but that was a good point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Corey, question for you. How often do your groups work with the cities that will help either establish a TIF district or any kind of a permit and fees, sack and whack charges, discounts? Obviously, those are big expenses to developments. So does your group work in tandem with those cities to help lower the cost of those development costs for affordable housing?
Mr. Corey.
In almost every situation, we're working with local municipalities or counties or both or economic development authorities to bring resources that help leverage state resources. There's almost never a sole source project. Sometimes it's 2 sources, sometimes it's 6.
Representative McDonald.
And then a follow-up. We dealt with this issue in Delano as well when I was the mayor, and we didn't really have a nonprofit group that was the middleman between the council, the mayor, the developers. We worked in tandem together. and cut out maybe the middleman, in this case the nonprofit group. So is it really a necessity that your group intervenes in that, and just how effective is that?
Mr. Corey.
I can't speak to all the markets, but I can say that in where we're operating, there just isn't construction happening. There aren't builders that want to take the risk to do it. So we step in and take the risk of actually acquiring the real estate, securing the resources, and then, you know, building the homes and putting them on the market. So, you know, it could be that in other markets, the model you're talking about works. I know in Rochester there has been some of that historically that worked, but where we're operating, you know, just a quick story, the city of Grand Marais, the Economic Development Authority in Cook County, they gave us an award at their gala this fall for the affordable homeownership work that we've developed in Grand Marais. They've been waiting for years for someone to come and do it. That just the contractors to do affordable construction, they're just not there. Many of the communities we work in, almost all of the contractors are just doing custom building. So,
very good. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just, you know, housing is a big issue and a huge need, but there's a large request that's before the Capital Investment Committee. And I'm just wondering if Representative Schultz or the testifier or maybe the housing agency could explain how that interacts. And maybe the two together still don't meet the need, but I think that's the question that we need to answer. And I don't know if the housing agency is here to explain how those two requests, if you will, interact with one another.
Representative Carlson, I think that's a great question. How do, you know, for example, the governor's proposal right now with housing dollars and what might the housing committee doing versus what tax here, how does all that work together? How would all those proposals work together? Mr. Corey.
Thank you. At this point in time, I think the resources you're referring to are the housing infrastructure bonds as part of the bonding proposal. Housing infrastructure bonds are only available presently for a very small segment of homeownership development, community land trust homeownership, but only the land acquisition and infrastructure and site clearing part of a project can be attributable to that. And so we are also working on separate legislation to expand the use of housing infrastructure bonds for affordable homeownership. If the overall housing pie, if you will, is getting bigger in terms of resources, we'd like to expand the slice that comes to homeownership, and we'd like it to be available for, you know, all affordable homeownership uses instead of just that small niche. We're grateful for the community land trust component, but it has complications associated with it as well. For example, if we get housing infrastructure bonds for, say, the homes in Grand Marais that we developed, we typically will have then two contracts with the state for each house, because there's two sources that flow in, one for the land and infrastructure and one for the rest of the construction. And in many of the places that we are working, the land value is smaller, and so we don't achieve the huge benefit that say someone in you know, West Hennepin County might if for example they got housing infrastructure bonds where the land is, you know, maybe six times greater in value per house than it is in Duluth. Did that answer the question?
Representative Carlson.
I'm just kind of weighing that all through. Yeah. It's my understanding that part of that program is to help first-time home buyers. That's why I was kind of perking up on it. And maybe if he could comment about the relationship there then, because I'm left with the impression that this is going to help renters, by and large, who would probably almost all be first-time homeowners from the testimony we received. And it was my understanding that those bonds were that are before the Capital Investment Committee and historically were to help first-time home buyers, and that's what I was trying to get a handle on in terms of how the two interacted together. Maybe I should have mentioned first-time home buyers in my first question, if maybe we could get some help with that.
Mr. Corey, did you understand the question on the first-time home buyer and the relationship here?
I believe I do.
Okay.
So, like I was trying to say before and maybe didn't say as well as I should have, the housing infrastructure bonds are primarily used for rental housing of different sorts. There's a very small amount, like, I forget the exact number, but it's like 1% maybe of the housing infrastructure bonds that have been allocated to date have gone to homeownership, and it's only been for that community land trust piece. So the bill I was talking about where we're hoping to expand the use is being carried by Representative Hausman, and that would broaden the use of housing infrastructure bonds for homeownership, and then there would be more of those funds that would be used for first-time home buyers. At this point in time, it's a very, very small amount of those funds that can be used for first-time home buyer.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I was referencing. I said the issue that it's before, well, I guess the Housing Committee. I was thinking of the Capital Investment Committee, but that's what I was referring to, how that legislation interacts with this legislation, because it looks like on the face of it that they may have some of the same goals. But I can learn more about it later. But I do have one other question. How the bill is tracked, because there was reference to the bill from last year as before Ways and Means. So is that tracked totally separate? Because the motion before us now is for possible inclusion, which I understand why, because of the tax implications. But the other bill was tracked apparently separately, and it's been a year since I've looked at what was referred. Maybe we can talk about that offline or later, just how things were tracked before and how they're being tracked this time.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. And so last year, this bill would have had to come to taxes last year. Yeah, added.
Sitting in Ways and Means,
right.
So that's why I'm asking.
880,
there.
Right.
But we can work.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
I think it's a tax question, you know, as I looked at
it. Certainly, yes. Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Corey, just to be clear on the 1% that you're talking about on those housing infrastructure bonds, I think you said that was all that was allowed. Is that by rule or is that by statute? And how would the Hausman bill clear that up or open that up?
Mr. Corey.
I believe it's a statutory change that's required, and that's what we're pushing for. And I might not have the percent exactly right, but it's in that ballpark. It's a very small amount. So we're looking for a statutory change to change the use to an expanded use for affordable homeownership development.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, any closing comments?
Well, thank you, members of the committee, for hearing the bill. And I just want to emphasize that Minnesota Housing received over $6 million in requests from 23 organizations when we only had $750,000 in this fund. So there is a great need for more revenue to go into this fund. So I hope you will support this bill.
Representative Schultz moves to lay over House File 2601 as amended for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Next up, we have House File 3670, Representative Becker Finn, and I will wait as she gets to the table there. And Representative Becker Finn, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3670 be laid over.
Very good. Please proceed.
All right. So House File 3670 has to do specifically with discharged student loan debt in the year 2018. And typically, discharged debt is counted as income, but the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 added an exclusion for the years 2018 through 2025. In our 2019 omnibus tax bill, we included years 2019 to 2025. So there's a small group of folks, it's about 75 filers that are impacted by this. So the cost overall is only $60,000, but that's about $800 per filer. And this is focused on folks who had their student loan debt discharged because of death or disability. And so this is disproportionately hitting veterans who are disabled and their student loan debt is just discharged, and then they're getting hit with a higher tax bill. And then also parents who've co-signed on to student loans whose children then passed away. And so, again, it's kind of a small group of people that we're helping out here, but it will mean a lot to those impacted.
So, Representative Becker Finn, in short, we have to go back to 2018, retroactive, move it back 1 year.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's just for 1 year.
Yeah. Any questions from members here? If not, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify in regards to House File 3670? Seeing none, Representative Becker Finn, any closing comments?
No, I'm happy to get us moving on the calendar and get this before the committee for so we can hopefully address that this year.
Thank you so much for bringing this forward.
Yep.
Appreciate that.
And I will renew my motion that 3670 be laid over.
Thank you very much. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda, House File 1642. Representative Joachim, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for hearing 1642. I'd like to make a motion to move House File 1642 to be laid over for further consideration.
Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you. I do have an A1 amendment to move to get the bill in order. I'd like the committee to discuss it.
All right. Hold on just a second. So members should have the A2 amendment. So Representative Joachim moves the A2 amendment. Would you care to address that?
Yes, the A1 amendment, I believe.
I think we...
Okay. I may have the wrong amendment myself.
I think what we want is Mr. Williams. Which one do we want?
Chair and members, I believe the A1 amendment and the A2 amendment are very similar, but the A2 amendment has a corrected effective date based on technical assistance from the Department of Revenue, so I think the A2 amendment is the correct one.
Representative Joachim, you want to, and I think members have the A2 amendment.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see this now. So, yes, the A2 amendment does just change the effective date for projects placed.
So we'll move the, Representative Joachim moves the A2 amendment, just to make that clear. All right, so what does that do?
The A2 amendment actually takes away section one of the bill, because we dealt with that during the tax conformity last year. And then section two addresses the assignees and credit certification. And then it also adjusts the effective date to be effective for projects placed in service after December 31st, 2019.
All right, any discussion on the A2 amendment? Now I'm going to call for the vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The A2 amendment is adopted. Please proceed with your bill as amended.
Thank you, members. Sorry for the confusion there. So the historic tax credit stabilizes and defines the unique character of communities, especially our small towns, main streets across the state. The construction workforce that is employed on the historic tax credit projects in Minneapolis and St. Paul, for instance, have reached beyond their borders with crews coming throughout from the 15-county metropolitan area. The historic tax credit creates opportunities for small business entrepreneurship and development, as well as results in new employment opportunities in completed buildings. The credit also has been used to create housing units in vacant and underutilized buildings all across Minnesota. For instance, more than 5,000 units of affordable housing have been added or retained using the historic tax credit. And because the tax credit must be paired with use from the federal historic tax credit, these projects bring in federal dollars and financial resources that wouldn't otherwise be able to be used. This can alleviate some of the cost burdens on other public affordable housing financing programs, making more funds available to meet other state housing needs. I do have a few testifiers here to walk through the bill and explain the benefits in extending the historic tax credit. They will each take only a few minutes. I have Aaron Haffenberg here from Rethos, which is formerly known as the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. I have Brigid Tuck, University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality, and Greg Handren from ArtSpace, and then batting cleanup is Adam Dunnock from the Carpenters Union.
Very good. Welcome. Please state your name.
Good morning, Chair, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Erin Hannafenberg. As Representative Joachim said, I am with Mythos. We're the organization that used to be called the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. We changed our name in August, but we still have the same mission, nonprofit mission, which is to promote community vitality through the reuse and rehabilitation of historic places. One of the best tools that is available to help us fulfill our broad mission is the Minnesota Historic Structure Rehabilitation Tax Credit. This tax credit is administered by the State Historic Preservation Office at the Department of Administration in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Revenue and the National Park Service. The Minnesota Historic Tax Credit was adopted in 2010 as part of a jobs bill in response to the Great Depression, or recession, rather. With that, Minnesota joined 35 other states to have a state income tax credit that can be paired with a federal historic tax credit to incentivize the private rehabilitation of buildings that are listed in the National Register of Historic Places and used for commercial purposes. When we appeared before you in 2013, Chair Marquardt was the lead author on a bill to extend the sunset past its initial 2015 date. Now, based on the strong return on investment that this public-private partnership allows, we are asking you to make the historic tax credit permanent before it sunsets next year. The bill would also allow for the credits to be transferred more than once. Many other states allow this to occur, and this flexibility would bring more access to the capital that is needed to get these complex projects initiated and completed before the tax credits are able to be claimed. If the Department of Revenue has concerns about administering these transfers, which we've heard before, we're willing to talk about putting some limits on the number of transfers or adding an administrative fee. Other testifiers will provide a little bit more detail about the economic returns and the impact that the historic tax credits have helped bring about. Okay. But I want to point out to you that before the historic tax credit was passed in 2010, Minnesota typically saw two or three of these kinds of projects a year, just using the federal historic tax credit that's been available since the mid-1980s. In the past 10 years, 133 historic buildings have been rehabilitated and reoccupied. Tens of thousands of jobs have been created, and these projects alone have resulted in $3.3 billion of economic activity in the state. None of this would have occurred on this scale without the Minnesota historic tax credit. As Representative Joachim stated, we have calculated that more than 5,000 housing units have been created or retained as affordable using the paired state and federal historic tax credits, and that this brings both access to private capital as well as federal resources that would not otherwise be available. And this helps alleviate some of the reliance on other sources of public funding for housing development. There's still plenty of opportunity and lots of need to repurpose vacant and underutilized buildings and communities throughout the state. Adaptively reusing existing structures should be a part of the state's strategy for addressing climate change, since constructing new buildings, especially ones made out of concrete and steel, is very energy intensive, and there are significant carbon impacts to demolishing buildings and hauling debris to the landfill. Elizabeth Flannery and Adam Dunick both had last-minute work conflicts pop up this morning and are not able to be here to testify. Ms. Flannery's organization, the Community Housing Development Corporation, recently completed the Emerson Union project in the former New Ulm High School, and there's information about that project in your packets, I believe. The building's Jobs Coalition has been supportive of the historic tax credit since 2010, and the Carpenters Union is one of the many building trades union groups that support this program. Mr. Dunick was planning, I believe, to speak in support of this bill. I will turn it over to the other testifiers, but first I want to thank you for your having established the Minnesota Historic Tax Credit in the first place. Communities across Minnesota have been able to see their unique places revitalized using this tool, and they are more interesting, resilient, and financially sound, I believe, because of your past support. Thank you.
Representative Gomez, I know you're on the list. Did you want to ask a question now or wait for the testifiers to complete?
Either way.
Okay, so we'll, all right, so please continue. We'll go to the next testifier.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bridget Tuck. I work for University of Minnesota Extension. I have the fortune of being able to work across the state with communities to help them envision their economic future. As part of that, I have every year been analyzing the economic impact of the tax credit. So it is actually written right into the legislation that annually the State Historic Preservation Office will evaluate the impact. So our analysis, as Aaron mentioned, has generated $3.3 billion worth of economic activity in the state as a result of the tax credit. This includes the generation of nearly 18,000 jobs. If you recall, back in 2010, when this was passed, we were in the height of the Great Recession, and particularly the construction industry was one that was most affected. So 18,000 construction jobs created as a result of the tax credit. And probably what we economists would argue is more important is $1.1 billion in labor income generated. So that is money right into the pockets of the people who work on these projects that they can take home and then spend in their communities. And if you look at where those impacts are, some of the industries that benefited the most from this activity include wholesale trade, which is your business-to-business transactions, but also the housing market, as well as finance and trucking. So some of the industries that benefited the most. In total, the tax credit awarded was $357.7 million, which seems like kind of a large number, until you realize that the tax credit private developers matched $1.5 billion in their own money to do those projects. So if you break that down, for every dollar in state public investment, there was $9.17 in economic activity generated in the state. That includes $1 of federal investment because there is a matching federal tax credit, as well as $4.30 from private developers, and then about $2.90 in economic activity at the businesses that support construction activity in our state. When we first started this analysis, because we had to do it annually, we only had information on the construction. We only sort of knew what that was going to be. But we knew that because the bill says there has to be an income-producing purpose for the building, that there was new activity that was happening, whether it's apartment rentals and freeing up workforce space, or whether it be, you know, a lot of them have on the main floor maybe some retail space, commercial space. So we started doing case studies about halfway through. So in your packet, you do have the case studies that we did for the most recent study. But one case study really stood out to me when I kind of did the math in my own head here. The Chittenden and Eastman building, which is located in St. Paul, before the rehabilitation, the market value was $1.7 million. Following it, it jumped to $19.8 million. So annual property taxes increased by an estimated $380,000 a year. So within 15 years, the property taxes alone would repay the tax credit investment by the state, which is important. You know, property taxes are important revenue streams for our schools and our communities. So this is, again, kind of a little bit of a conservative analysis because we only focused on the construction impacts and not sort of those impacts from the production, whatever happens in those buildings afterwards. But we do this annually to satisfy that requirement.
Thank you. Representative, another testifier. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Handberg, and for the record, I'd like to correct my last name. It's H-A-N-D-B-E-R-G. I am the Senior Vice President of Properties for ArtSpace Projects. ArtSpace is a 501c3 nonprofit developer of affordable housing and arts-related commercial space. We are located in Minneapolis but active nationally. ArtSpace has created 54 facilities across the country, including 14 properties in the state of Minnesota. We operate properties in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Hastings, Duluth, Fergus Falls, Brainerd. Most of what we do is affordable housing with arts-related commercial space as additional use. Of the 14 buildings that we operate in the state of Minnesota, 9 are historic. We have used the federal historic tax credit extensively across the country. We were one of the first buildings in Minnesota to use the state historic tax credit. The Northern Warehouse in St. Paul, Minnesota, was recapitalized in 2011 using the state historic tax credit. It preserved 52 affordable housing units for low-income families in St. Paul and improved 40,000 square feet of commercial space that's occupied by businesses in the Lower Town neighborhood of St. Paul. Currently, ArtSpace is working on a large project in the city of Minneapolis. We recently acquired the Northrop King campus in northeast Minneapolis. Northrop King comprises 727,000 square feet of space. Approximately half of that is vacant and blighted, and the other half is occupied by 350 artists and arts-related businesses. The state historic tax credit would provide critical last funding to complete the rehabilitation of the existing vacant space and the capital improvement of the currently occupied space. You know, the historic tax credit, both federal and state, is an incredibly efficient program. The investment to dollar of tax credit, approximately 90 to 95 cents. It is incredibly efficient. It's it preserves resources that affordable housing resources for projects that may not be historic by providing this additional source of capital for historic properties. Historic properties are expensive to rehabilitate given the blighted nature of many of these properties. They're also critical to the fabric of community all across the state. Again, the work that we've done, the work that this tax credit is helping facilitate is a statewide kind of improvement program. We've really seen the impact of this on Main Street in Fergus Falls and in Brainerd and in Duluth. So support, hope for your support for this initiative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Joachim, any other testifiers?
I believe we have one more.
Okay, and then we've got a couple on the list.
Or two, actually two more. Or a couple on the list after this, so.
Oh.
Oh, I guess we just, no, sorry. I forgot the one person wasn't able to come, so.
Okay, so welcome, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joanna Bears, and I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Currently, the Minnesota Historic Structure Rehabilitation Credit is a refundable credit that's allowed for qualifying expenditures to rehabilitate a certified historic structure. The state credit is equal to 20% of the qualifying expenditures. Both the federal and state credit are paid out over 5 years. The current credit can be transferred to another taxpayer, which is often used for Minnesota financing purposes. The tax credit will sunset on June 30th, 2021, and the Department of Revenue jointly administers this program with the Department of Administration. House File 1642 makes a couple changes to the current historic structure rehabilitation credit, expands the transferability of the credit to allow more than one transfer, and it repeals the sunset to make this provision permanent. The governor supports the goals of the historic rehabilitation as it preserves the identity of community. Since the historic structural rehabilitation program's adoption in 2010, 133 projects have received the state credit to use in connection with housing, business and retail uses, artist live work units or live work units, community spaces, and theaters. If this bill moves forward, we're happy to work with the author on any administrative questions that we may have. Thank you.
Very good. All right, so let's go to questions. We've got four. We'll get to all the testifiers. So, Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who might be able to answer this. I think it was the first testifier who talked about the number of units that have been produced over, you know, you talked about 5,000 units. And I wonder if you can contextualize for me what the sort of like average cost per unit is and what the sort of tax benefit per unit is and how that compares to production of other like affordable home units, rental units. Maybe that's a little like outside the scope, but if you can give me an idea, I guess what I'm trying to get at is like, you know, I come from a community that we're in the middle of a housing crisis. And so it's really important that we use dollars that we're devoting to, housing production in a way that's most efficient. And so I'm just wondering if the cost per unit is considerably higher for these projects versus other kinds of, especially affordable rental projects.
Ms. Hannifin-Berg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, I'm not going to be able to answer the actual cost question right now, but I will definitely look up and get some more information. I think Mr. Handberg might be able to talk a little bit more about some of the units because they were more in the development stage. I will say that there's been a wide spectrum of the cost and the affordability for the units that have been created using the historic tax credit. One of the very first projects that was completed with the historic tax credit was the Renaissance Box project in downtown St. Paul, in Lower Town. And that was an affordable housing complex. Western U Plaza, which is just down the street on University Avenue, is another one that was intended for deeply affordable units. And that it goes all the way up to market rate. But there's quite a number of projects that have been constructed with the sole purpose of providing affordable housing through historic tax credits. I know that a number of other nonprofit housing developers, like, they rely on this to be a tool. There's not a single scale, affordable housing developer that works at scale that has not had a need to use this credit in one of their projects. And so it's been really, really vital for them to be able to access other additional capital as well. As for the costs, you know, all construction is pretty expensive right now. I mean, there's definitely infrastructure costs that don't have to be assumed for the vast majority of historic projects that are being rehabilitated, because those are already hooked up to city sewer and on the grid, and as opposed to being, you know, developed in a new area, you don't have to extend streets and sewers and all of that kind of infrastructure out there. And so there's some savings in terms of the overall costs to a community in that respect. And then also more of the costs of a rehabilitation project go towards labor than go towards materials in a new in a historic rehabilitation project. You know, it's more refinishing flooring and structure and wood and walls and all that kind of thing, and a lot less than on the new building materials that have to be brought in from other places, and then there's, you know, a lot more material costs with that. So in terms of what the actual return is on investment and where money is well spent, we actually believe that historic rehabilitation is the best way to make good use of the state's investment, because it is supporting actual working wages and then going right back into the community. I try to point out that a sheet of drywall is not getting a haircut or buying food for their family, but somebody who's repairing plaster is. So that's really, really critical there. I will ask Greg Handberg if he could address a little bit more of the cost piece, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah. Mr. Handberg.
Good morning. Cost containment is an issue. Is the area of focus of whether it's MHFA or City of Minneapolis or City of Fergus Falls. I mean, project cost underwriting and making sure the projects are not too expensive and an affordable housing kind of perspective is something that everybody's very, very focused on to make sure that resources are allocated in an efficient way. Historic preservation is typically more expensive than new construction. But the historic tax credit, that's what makes the historic tax credit so important. And the historic tax credit allows an additional source of financing to become available that helps reduce the comparative cost of a historic preservation project, to perhaps even below, after your consideration of the tax credit, the cost of new construction. So this historic tax credit, state and federal, helps bring down the cost net of the proceeds from the tax credit to something that's very competitive, very attractive relative to new construction. It's very important.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you for that. So there's no, like, affordability requirement associated with these funds? They can be used for market rate or?
That's correct. There is no affordability.
Mr. Handberg.
Correct. Yeah. Mr. Handberg, yes. There is no affordability requirement related to the use of historic tax credits. When historic tax credits are used to create affordable housing, there are affordability requirements that come along with the affordable housing tools that are used. To the previous question, in the Northrop King building, we're anticipating that it's a mixed-use project. We anticipate approximately 100 units of affordable housing. The total development cost of that component of the project would be approximately $30 million, and that falls within the City of Minneapolis guidelines for affordable housing. The tax credits, the state tax credit generated on that $30 million investment would be in the neighborhood of $5 million, $5.5 million. And that helps reduce the need for other affordable housing resources that might be requested as part of that development scenario.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and are these, is the historic structure rehabilitation credit only used for housing, or is it used for other things also?
It can be used.
Mr. Handberg.
It can be used for mixed use, for commercial, for housing, for
okay.
A variety
and
of
so there's types. And there's no, like, percentage that has to be devoted
Representative
to housing.
Gomez.
Sorry. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
There's no, like, percentage that needs to be used for housing. It could be used for any purpose, this $100 million over the 5 years, roughly.
Representative Joachim, did you want to get in on this a little bit?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to remind folks, too, that the number one purpose of this bill is to rehab historic buildings and to use underutilized buildings in our across the state in our communities. But one of the benefits of this is being able to leverage the federal tax dollars, which frees up other money that's out there. And housing is one of the components. And as kind of Representative Carlson pointed out, there's a lot of housing dollars out there that we're trying to work with to hit our housing crisis. Yeah. This is just going to be another tool in the toolbox. And I believe that having as many tools in the toolbox is really important if we're going to tackle this big issue.
Representative Gomez, anything to finish up with here?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. to Representative Gomez's kind of line of questioning, I think, you know, they kind of skirted around it. I mean, I think the news articles that I've read is just the Fort Snelling project. They're looking to combine federal and state grants, and I think it's going to be looking at $600,000 per unit. And so for anyone to make the argument that this is, you know, if you're trying to produce actual units, it's $600,000 the kind of the sweet spot? I really don't think so. While I appreciate historic buildings and the rest, but if this is, I mean, you know, I think this is sold generally as low-income housing generator, you know, this is probably fairly poor place to do it as far as actually putting people in homes. You know, I mean, if you're really looking at, you know, the quality of the home and putting some things out there, you know, I think Minneapolis and St. Paul was like $440,000 per unit. So on average, maybe it's a little bit less, maybe it's a little more. But, you know, I mean, if we're really looking at dollars to spend, I think we really need to evaluate, like, is this the best place for us to be doing it from a federal and from a state-sponsored area? Well, we want to beautify our home, our downtown areas. But, you know, if this is really about achieving our goals, you know, I think, I appreciate the bill, Representative Joachim, but, you know, I believe making anything permanent. You know, we had a bill that the chairman brought around about really talking from a tax expenditure standpoint of ending those things by kind of creating a program like this that has to have no review from the legislature that could potentially just move on and on and on by making it permanent. You know, I really think that has a potential to have less oversight. That's my two cents.
Representative Joachim, you want to respond?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind folks, too, that the number one goal for this is to preserve historic buildings. And a lot of, like, the U of M extension on testimony shows that a lot of the benefits that come with this is also saving resources and looking at how the cost is on new material versus old material, and that the leveraging of federal dollars and the money that has been brought into state and economic interest. You're right. It has to be a balance. Is this just an affordable housing tool? No.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have three really quick questions. And the first two are for the department. You went over pretty quickly how many projects has been done in the past. This $31 million a year, do we know about how many projects that was, that will be? And then the second question for it is, can a building qualify 10 years from now, for example, if they need to do another project?
Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to refer to some of my colleagues here who oversee that area of the work.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr.
Please state
Chair
your name.
And members of the committee, I'm Amy Spong, the Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer in the Department of Administration. Representative, would you mind repeating your question?
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, the two questions were, do we know this $31 million as projected to be the cost over from the revenue analysis indicates about $31 million over there. Do we know about how many projects per year that's going to be? And the second follow-up question was, can a building qualify 10 years from now, for example, if they need to do another project?
And before I call on you, would you say your last name a little slower, please?
Yes, Spong, S-P-O-N-G.
Spong, very good, yes. Ms. Spong.
Thank you. So since the State Historic Tax Credit was adopted in 2010, our office, we were averaging about 14 applications per year. Currently, since the start of our current state fiscal year, we have 12 applications that have been processed in our office just in the first two quarters. And we have an additional about seven initial applications in addition to that 12 since in our current fiscal year.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And the follow-up question was, can facilities qualify into the future, or is this just a one-time option?
Ms. Fong.
Mr. Chair and Representative, they can. There are some formulas that need to be met, and I have, you heard some of the testimony today of the building in Lower Town St. Paul that initially utilized the federal historic tax credit in the 1980s, I believe, and they have now come back for additional rehabilitation work. So yes, they can. There are certain parameters they have to meet. You usually can't do it there's a five-year recapture period. So it usually takes several years before they could do another project.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And this follow-up last question is, maybe Mr. Chair or fiscal staff might know this. I don't believe all of the sales tax exemptions we've heard so far, I don't think we have heard any for historical preservation yet at this point. Is that correct?
Representative Petersburg, that's correct.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for the Department of Revenue, probably Ms. Bader. Ayers? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep,
so, Ms. Bayers, this new language is for subsequent signees. Do you have a projection on how many might be assigned this tax credit over the 5 years? You know, have you made any projections? Because I noticed that the revenue will decrease. Well, not necessarily. There will be losses in 2023, but after that.
Ms. Bayers?
Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative. We haven't made a projection. This is a unique credit where it allows that transfer, and we don't have another credit like that at this time. And specifically, we don't have another credit that allows multiple transfers. So I think one of the things that we need to do is get more information about how this credit is being transferred, looking at other states or looking at other programs, and just to get more information about it before we can make that projection and how it might be transferred or how many times it might be transferred.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Bayers, will you be reporting to the legislature in regard to how this plays out if this becomes law?
Ms. Bayers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe it has a reporting requirement.
It doesn't. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I perked up with the Northrop King building. I used to work in it when I was in college, Summers Grass Seed. But at any rate, that's just an aside. But I'm curious, are these buildings or some of the buildings on the National Registry of Historical Sites? And where is the line? You know, the reason I bring up the Northrop King building, that was a warehouse. Now we're talking about housing. So is it the exterior that's retained, because they would literally, I think, have to gut that back to just the frame of the building, if you will, and it's huge. You could easily get lost in it when I worked there. But maybe if the gentleman from that referenced Northrop King could just quickly comment, or somebody, if some of the buildings end up or are on the National Historic Sites. That was my main question.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Joaquin. Ms. Fong is willing to answer that question.
Okay. Very good. Ms. Fong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. It is a requirement that all of the, in order to be eligible for both the federal and the state historic tax credit, the property does have to be considered eligible, certified as eligible for the National Register, and ultimately listed on the National Register. And I believe to answer the second part of your question, the National Park Service, the State Historic Preservation Office, administers the federal credit with the National Park Service. And so we are the first point of contact for all of the project proponents. And the National Park Service ultimately reviews the work so that it meets federal standards and guidelines. We do look at the exterior and the interior to ensure that they, you know, we recognize that change is going to happen for these properties. We want to keep them in use, but that there is a set of guidelines that are reviewed and evaluated according.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if the bill author or, I don't know, any of the number of folks who have made comments here today, can you tell me, is there a breakdown as far as how many assignees, people who receive this credit, are for-profit and non-profit entities?
Anyone care to answer that? Ms. Spears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, I can't give you the breakdown of that, but I can tell you that most of this credit, the transfer is to obtain financing, so it depend on who the financer would be. So most of the time it might be a bank or some other type of financing.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the financer would essentially be getting the income tax credit.
Mr. Chair, yes, they would get the credit.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up then, Ms. Bears, it sounded, or at least in your last comments from Representative Erickson's questioning, it sounds like you, more information is needed about the mechanisms or the process for reassigning these credits to other entities. I just wonder how many times in our tax code we have reassignable credits, and with this, what this bill wants to do is reassign a reassignable credit. I just wonder, I mean, is this creating a market for these credits? I know it's a very different situation, but I just think of the North Dakota and the Fargo liquor licenses where there's actually a market for the liquor licenses. So, I mean, would there be a situation where somebody's getting the credit just to get it so they can profit from it, just to sell it?
Ms. Baird?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lean, it's hard for me to speculate on whether that what that market would look like. This is a credit that's different than other credits in the fact that it is assignable. And so we don't currently have another credit that does that.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bears, I appreciate that. And, you know, it sounds like more information is needed. I guess I didn't expect an answer to that. But, you know, it's just something I guess I wanted to bring up just for us all to think about. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean was actually kind of on the line of thinking that I was kind of curious about. I wonder if somebody can just like explain the kind of policy rationale for having this be, I don't know, what did you call it, transferable?
Reassignable.
Reassignable credit? Having, since it's a unique thing, I don't know if Mr. Williams has any.
Very good.
Thing he can share.
Mr. Williams.
Chair and members, I think that one of the major rationales for having this be assignable is that there's a lot of nonprofits engaged in this space, and so it's a way to provide a tax credit to an entity that doesn't pay taxes.
Representative Gomez.
So is it only nonprofits who can claim the credit as like on the kind of first round, and then they sell it to a bank or a for-profit institution?
Mr. Williams.
Chair, Representative Gomez, it's not just nonprofits that can claim the credit, so any organization that places a qualifying project into service can claim the credit, but I think that sort of this assignment mechanism is primarily intended for entities that are tax exempt.
Very good.
You know.
Okay. Representative Swinson.
Thank you. Just from a mechanics, maybe Mr. Williams would be able to answer this. So essentially, from a sales tax perspective and how they're reflected into material purchase. So if you're a nonprofit entity doing the project initially, you would gain sales tax possibility when they're doing the project, and then from the transferability of that tax credit. Is that how this is kind of playing out when we're looking at this?
Ms. Dalton? Boy, that was quick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, although a nonprofit could technically get a sales tax exemption on the construction because of the fact that they have to take on the liability for any potential flaw in the construction materials, that virtually never happens.
Okay.
So there is no sales tax exemption that kind of falls into this on a general basis.
Okay, thank you. I was just thinking,
Swisinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just was thinking from a combination, from a tactical standpoint of the development of these, if that was being utilized as kind of a, as a cost saver from doing that. And I think Representative Lean kind of hit on it. I think Representative Gomez talking about, you know, I think absolutely if you can transfer these things, it absolutely makes them more liquid, makes them more viable thing to sell and do and there's, yeah, so. That would be my guess.
But we're having really a good discussion here, and so what I would like to do is finish the day with this bill. So, you know, we've got House File 3496, taxpayer-free filing, but the author's here and I know can come back. Is there anyone in the audience who was here for House File 3496, which is a taxpayer-free filing, that would like to testify on that, that could not come back another day? You've traveled some distance and you cannot come back. Is there anyone in the audience on that bill? Because I think we're going to move that bill to another day. All right. Very good. So let's continue with this. And so I think Representative Swisinski, were you done? So Representative
Mr. Chair.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you to this discussion right now. I think I have Mr. Hanberg from ArtSpace has something to add about the transferable credit.
Mr. Hanberg.
Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak to the assignment and reassignment discussion that's been happening. The assignment is important because it is, whether it's for-profit or non-profit, the developer of property using this historic tax credit is likely to sell the rights to the tax credit to an investor in the project. And so that relates to the assignment. Because the tax credit is taken each year over 5 years, the reassignment is important, not so much because there might be a secondary market for these credits, but rather because the tax situation of the investor in those credits may change over that 5 year period. And I think that the reassignment provision provides a mechanism should they not need access to that tax credit in year three or in year four for them to transfer that and assign that to another party through sale. And I think that it really, when you think about the efficiency of this tax credit in terms of the investment per dollar of tax credit provided, the reassignment makes the credit much more valuable to the project that it's intended to benefit, and that's demonstrated in the proceeds that are generated. So thank you.
Very good. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for probably the author or perhaps someone else that on the staff. There's a scenario in my district, perhaps it's the same case with many of you, that a historical building, a city owns it. It's built in 1888, the former city hall and fire department building, but it's crumbling right now in the infrastructure. How does this tax credit and or would this tax credit benefit a city who is looking to invest its taxpayers' dollars in preserving a historic building?
Who would like to? Sanofin Burke?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, this is a project that the historic tax credit is only available for commercial rehabilitations of buildings that are listed on the National Register, so it's pretty difficult for a city-owned property to qualify as that commercial use. There would either have to be some kind of sale of the city-owned property to for-profit or nonprofit commercial entity, or there would have to be a very complex arrangement between those parties to allow for the credit to be claimed, since it's a historic, it's a tax credit. Yeah. There are there are legacy grants available for that kind of thing, though, in another state program.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would care to testify on House File 1642 as amended? Seeing none. Members, any questions of the author? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more thought or question on the reassignability of these credits. Is it more or less a part of the financing package that gets included with any payments the nonprofit would have to make for the financing? It sounded like these credits oftentimes go to financial institutions to help with the is that sort of part of the payment package or something to that effect?
I can attempt to answer that, Mr. Chair, Representative Lean. So the way that I think about this in my mind is that the work on these historic buildings has to happen up front. So somebody has to pay for the labor and the construction and the materials and all that kind of stuff. And so, yes, access to that financing and the ability to pay those bills before the tax credit can be claimed. The tax credit cannot be claimed until the project is placed in service. So the promise of those historic tax credits that are out there is one of the things that's able to secure other outside investors, and is also one of the things that brings that initial capital to a developer that might not have access to that. You either have to have really deep pockets to be able to fund that work up front and claim your tax credit on the end, or you have to have a way to access that other thing, that other capital. So it's these projects can be very complex in terms of their capital stack. I do know about one project that was done before the Minnesota Historic Tax Credit was available, done only with a federal tax credit, the Ripley Gardens Maternity Hospital, that's affordable housing in North Minneapolis, that had 17 different funding sources in it to be able to get that project completed. So these are really complicated, but one of the things that makes them less complicated is the ability to attract outside investors through the sale of the credits.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so one more, I don't know, I don't need really a response on this, one more thought. You know, all due respect to the author, maybe just the reassignability of the assignability, you know, is maybe just one step too far. And maybe we can put some other sort of guardrails around this, sort of like an expiration date on the credit. You know, not so much dealing with the sunset, but just saying if after 7 years the credit's not claimed, to give time for the construction to happen and everything like that. It just might be some guardrails we can put around it. So thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Just quickly, a thought, Mr. Chair. Many of the old historic buildings in rural Minnesota, some of them, are, I should say, are owned by the city. And there's few opportunity, even with the legacy money, because those dollars are not, you know, there's a lot of requirements and they're needed in other areas. But question is, if the original project developer can reassign the tax credit to a different taxpayer, would it be safe to say that a building that's owned by the city is also owned by the taxpayers who reside in that city, and therefore should be able to reassign them? Wouldn't that be the case?
Sounds like the McDonald addendum. Yes. We are going to leave that out there. And
I'll wait for an answer food, at the next meeting.
Yes. With that, Representative Joachim, if you want to answer that, but this is your chance for your final comments.
I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair, for having the bill up. And members, thank you for the discussion. I really appreciate the interest in the bill. The historic tax credit plays an important role in our communities. As we lay this over, I'd be more than willing to work with members' concerns, including adding a fee on the subsequent transfers, or putting guardrails around them or an expiration date. Looking at the reporting requirements and looking at whether or not we just repeal the sunset or extend it. So I just want to thank folks for the discussion today and would love your support as we move this bill forward.
Very productive discussion today. Thank you, members. And Representative Joachim lays over House File 1642 as amended for possible inclusion into the tax on this bill. Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Do you want us to save Representative Joachim's other bill and put it back in our packets? Yes, I see your CLA shaking her head.
Yes,
that would be good.
That would be good, yes.
Save the paper.
Representative Erickson, you're always so good on things like that. Yes, keep that House File 3496 in your packs. Members, tomorrow is the Department Policy and Technical Bill. So everyone in the audience, you better reserve your seats tonight if you want to see this excitement for tomorrow. With that, members, we are adjourned.